Welcome to How to Use Power and Authority in Business Today, cassette number 2 in Dr. Mortimer Feinberg's series, Practical Psychology for Managing People. After more than 30 years as an executive advisor, management consultant, and researcher into the psychology of effective management, Dr. Feinberg has come to believe that the use of power and authority, the ability to use power and authority effectively and wisely, is critical to the success of both individual executives and the organizations in which they work. Dr. Feinberg defines power very simply as the ability to get things done through other people. But exactly how do you do this? How do you establish yourself as an effective leader of other people? How do you make certain that other people see you as a leader? How do you preserve and maintain your position as a leader? And most importantly, precisely how do you go about using the power and authority you have to accomplish your goals and the goals of your organization? All of these questions and many others are answered in detail in this single power-packed program. In it, you'll hear about why the ability to use power is critical to your success. You'll hear about the personality traits of the powerful executive. You'll hear about the specific ways in which you can establish and then project your position as a powerful manager. And you'll hear about the pitfalls you must step around if you want to avoid becoming a counterfeit executive. But even more importantly, Dr. Feinberg will tell you how you can delegate your power and your authority without running the risk of losing that power and authority. He'll give you the details of a fail-safe method of delegating that can multiply your ability to get things done. There's lots of important nitty-gritty material in this program. Listen to it once from beginning to end. Then listen again so you can fully understand Dr. Feinberg's ideas and methods. And, of course, keep the program handy so that Dr. Feinberg can serve as your own personal management advisor whenever you face a new problem in using your power and authority as a manager. So let's turn now to Dr. Feinberg and his program, How to Use Power and Authority in Business Today.
Power, power, power. People die for it. People claim that it is what makes the world go round, and I have been a student of power because I like to be among power people. And I'm reminded of a story which comes out of the Second World War, General Dwight David Eisenhower. Eisenhower, the day before D-Day, went up and down the line of the paratroopers. He said to one boy, "Are you looking forward to D-Day?" And the boy says, "Yes, sir," and he saluted sharply. Came to another boy, he says, "You're looking forward to D-Day?" And the boy says, "Yes, sir," and he saluted sharply. "So I'm looking forward to fighting for America and the removal of Hitler from the fortress of Europe." Third boy, short, comes over to him, General Eisenhower, snappily says to him, "Are you looking forward to D-Day?" And the little boy said, "No, sir." He said, "Are you looking forward to jumping?" He said, "No, sir." He said, "You are in the paratroopers, aren't you?" He said, "Yes, sir." He said, "If you don't looking forward to D-Day, you don't enjoy jumping, what the heck are you doing in the paratroopers?" And the boy said, "I don't like to jump, but I'd like to be among guys who like to jump. Now, I am not a power person, but I like to be among power people. And I've been an observer of power people. And I want you to know that in this tape, come with me into Macedonia." And that catchy title refers to a speech of Lucius Aemilius Paulus, who addressed the Romans in 168 B.C. And he said something like this. In every circle and truly at every table, there are people who lead armies into Macedonia, who know where the camps ought to be placed, what ports should be occupied by troops, when and through what passes the territory should be entered, where magazines should be formed, and how provisions should be conveyed. He said, "I am not one who think that commanders ought at no time to receive advice. On the contrary, I deem a man more proud than wise who regulates every proceeding by the standard of his own judgment. What then is my opinion? The commander should be counseled chiefly by persons of known talent, by those who have made the art of war their particular study and whose knowledge is derived from experience, from those who present at the scene of action, who see the country, who see the enemy, who see the advantages the occasions offer, and who, like people embarked in the same ship, are sharers of the same danger. If therefore anyone thinks himself qualified to give me the general advice respecting the war which I am to conduct, which may prove advantageous to the public, let him not refuse his assistance to the state, but let him come with me into Macedonia. Now, modestly, in the introduction to this tape, I am saying I have been with the generals into Macedonia. I have watched them in the use of power, and my knowledge is based upon experience, not just based upon an academic tradition. Let me see if I can combine my ego ideal, which is that I was with them in Macedonia, even though I am not a sharer of the same danger of an executive as an executive faces, I at least have been there with him. The ability of a man to use power is critical. And you have to understand this if you're going to be a manager. Now, I want to point out that I'm not talking about the use of power in what has been what I have humorously referred to as a bicycle type of leadership. And now a bicycle type of leadership is what some young people think the use of power is, which is that you kneel to the top and you pedal the people underneath. That is not true. That is not long-lasting power. Long-lasting power comes when the rank and file validate the leader's credentials. The essential fact in a situation is that people have agreed to allow themselves to be influenced by another, to accept his or her direction, criticism, and counsel. You know, it's one of the real problems in the United States is that we're not running out of leaders. Our people are as bright as they have ever been, in my opinion. And I have watched presidents since Franklin Roosevelt. I think the problem is we have run out of people who are willing to follow. And I think that you're going to find that changing as you face the 80s, that more people will be willing to accept direction from our presidents. I mean, we're always attacking our leaders. I guess that's one of the price of leadership. So let me look at the making of a leader. First point is, a leader is validated by his own followers. The extent to which one is accepted and perceived as a leader by others is the most important determinant of how effective he will be. A leader who is not accepted as a leader is not a leader at all. He may command behavior by external means, but often these means of power are inadequate. Similarly, a leader who is accepted needs fewer external means to influence others than a leader who is not accepted. That being the case, what kind of people tend to be perceived by others as having the ability to use power? Dr. Gazzelli, one of America's most outstanding industrial psychologists, has focused on two sets of characteristics. One, personality traits, which refer to intelligence, initiative, supervisory ability, self-assurance, affinity for subordinates, and decisiveness. Second, he referred to as motivational traits. By that he means a need for occupational achievement, a need for self-actualization, a need for power over others, a need for high financial reward, and a need for job security. Now, of course, they are found in varying degrees in equally successful leaders. The key to the success of any leader's use of power is his ability to combine such characteristics as I have just described. The power, just for the sake of power, does not seem to be as important to the success as a manager. Really, what I'm saying is, The process is more important than the goal. If you worry about how your body moves, you will automatically hit the ball. If you worry so much about how to hit the ball, you will hit it very poorly. If you worry about power, then you already have ruined yourself. You must worry about what makes up for effective use of power, not worrying about the power or the status. We find the most ineffective leaders, and I've heard this time and again from presidents of companies who say to me, if a guy is worried about his perks, he's going to be a terrible leader. If he worries about whether he has a chauffeur, if he worries about whether he has a private plane, if he worries about whether or not he has the perks of power, the status of power, rather than the ability to use it, then he is often ineffective. So I think it's very important to recognize that you stop worrying about power and you start worrying about what makes for effective leadership. One of the characteristics, then, in the use of power is the recognition that you don't trample on people. Two, that your validation comes from the troops. And that the use of power is fundamentally a personality characteristic. As I mentioned in an earlier tape, I'm very interested in politicians. And I want to put some flesh on the bones of an earlier statement in which I was quoted as having worked with Henry Kissinger at an American Management Association session on what makes for charisma. Power. Power of charisma. I addressed this question to Henry Kissinger, whether one likes him or not. He has been a great observer of all of the power figures almost of our time, since Franklin Roosevelt, Nelson Rockefeller, Charles de Gaulle, Mao Zedong. He knew them all. And Kissinger quoted, in response to my question, he quoted Adlai Stevenson, who was, as some of you may remember, was a former governor of the state of Illinois, twice candidate for the presidency. And Kissinger quoted Stevenson's remark. He said, "When I speak, people sit down and think. But when John Fitzgerald Kennedy spoke, they got up and marched." But charisma, or the trappings of power, is not enough. As Kissinger sees it, one has to differentiate between successful and unsuccessful charismatic leaders. Let's look at the successful use of power people. What are they like? He again pointed out it's a combination of personality and other characteristics. How does it translate, though, in action? How would you rate yourself in the use of power? How would you rate your subordinates? How would you do an interview? Select a power person. Let me give you some of the characteristics. One, high intelligence, but not necessarily brilliance. Now I'm going to get fancy with you. There is a curvilinear relationship between intelligence and effective use of power. By that I mean it's up to a certain point it's related to intelligence. After that, it's meaningless. It's about up to 120 IQ, which puts you in about the top 15%. If you got that, the rest of it is meaningless. You can be so smart that you'll trip over yourself. Intelligence is only partially related. You know, sometimes the most intelligent people, the Phi Beta Kappas of the world, do not make the great executives. I have done a study of how many Phi Beta Kappas there are in the presidents of Fortune 500 companies. And I'll tell you, it's a very, very small percentage. Now, it's a small percentage of Phi Beta Kappas in the country. But Phi Beta Kappas tend to look upon the world as a test, like they were in school. The result of that, they're always studying the book. They're not studying what they need to be understanding. And also, they tend to be so smart that they see too many facets to a question. To be a successful executive, one has to have high intelligence, but not necessarily brilliance. Brilliance may be counterproductive. Intelligence is related only up to a certain point. If I were to give you a 2x2 table, Now, it's a high IQ, high drive. The man may be too good. Make him a staff man. High IQ, low drive. A good line man. By that, I mean he likes to do other things. There's some inefficiency, built in some flexibility. Low IQ, low drive, good junior line officer. Low IQ, high drive, that guy'll kill you. Because you ask him where you're going, he says, I'll tell you when I get there. So the reverse is not true, that you don't need intelligence. You certainly do. But you don't need it in great quantities. Second, a clear vision of where you want to go. The successful user of power has well-defined goals and strategies. He's flexible, he may improvise, but always in light of his basic objectives. He uses his intelligence to assess and reassess his present position and to plan ahead, keeping in mind as many possible eventualities as can be conceived. Third, self-confidence. You gotta believe in yourself. A leader must believe, and he must not be self-pitying. He must believe that he can create conviction among his subordinates. He must see himself as an effective decision maker. I am not going to say that, the Cassius Clay syndrome of I am the greatest, or now as he's called Muhammad Ali, is the way to handle life. But nor do I believe that self-deprecation is an effective component of the use of power. The need to say to yourself that I may not be the best, but I can do better than anybody else or is equal to anybody else is very important. Fourth, wise delegation and reservations of power. Kissinger believes that successful leaders owe much to his ability to stake out the areas in which he will delegate and in which he will retain absolute control. Though the former Secretary of State cited no examples, other sources have faulted our former President Carter, for example, in this regard. A Washington correspondent of the New York Times has said privately that Carter overlearned the lessons taught by his former military boss, Admiral Rickover, who once said, "The devil is in the details." Unfortunately, constantly checking the devil in the details leaves one prey to the monster in the major issues, which are thus deprived of adequate attention. The trick is to distinguish between the critical and the trivial among the details. And a person who uses power well does this well. He knows what's an important detail and what's an unimportant detail. Fifth, an intimate knowledge of one's subordinates. And we have made this point in tape one. Let me repeat it again because I think it bears repetition. An intimate knowledge of one's subordinates. A good leader who knows how to use power knows his people better than they know themselves. As a result, he can get them to go beyond what they believe to be their capacities. I think it's important to recognize, and we made the point in the earlier tape, that an intimate knowledge of one's subordinates is an effective component of power use. All right, as I said at the beginning of the tape, I've been there. I've watched, and I also admire other men who have watched and been there. As Einstein said, if I see more than other men, it's only because I stand on the shoulders of other men. And therefore, I heavily quoted the Kissinger observations, which have been backed up, by the way, by psychological research. Let me review. One has to differentiate charismatic from unsuccessful charismatic leaders. One has to differentiate a Winston Churchill, a Franklin Roosevelt, from a Mussolini, a Hitler, a Stalin. One, high intelligence, but not necessarily brilliance. Two, a clear vision of where you want to go. Third, self-confidence, not arrogance. Four, wise delegation, but the reservation of power to oneself in critical areas. knowing the difference between when and how to delegate, when and how to see an important from an unimportant detail. Fifth, an intimate knowledge of one's subordinates. Assuming these characteristics, one will find that one's leadership is validated by one's subordinates rather than just grabbing at the status symbols of power. Men and women who use power have to understand that no one has the final answers. And I'd like to elaborate further from my observations beyond Kissinger's points, which were very fine. I'd like to point out some of the things he didn't mention on the use of power. Effective leaders have both intelligence and passion. Leadership requires that a man deeply care and has a sense of dedication to his followers, and they do know that he feels deeply about an issue. I was a great admirer of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, not so much for what he was, but for what he might have become after 8 years in the White House. And history denied him the opportunity to be the kind of president he wanted to be. And here I quote from his own words. I want to be a president who acts as well as reacts. One who originates programs as well as study groups. Who masters complex problems as well as one-page memorandums. I want to be a president who is a chief executive in every sense of the word, who responds to a problem not hoping his subordinates will act, but by directing them to act. A president who is willing to take the responsibility for getting things done and takes the blame if they are not done right. Very important. Intelligence and passion. Next, the rock-bottom essential of power use is knowing what's happening. You can't be a power in a vacuum. Men and women have to understand that in the use of power, they have to get down and kick the tires. A truly effective executive doesn't blame others for his problems. At the very least, the information of subordinates must get to the top so that you can look at it. Sometimes executives never get their information. Why don't they get knowledge? Because people of ineffective power, people keep too much of a distance from their subordinates. Subordinates frequently are reluctant to send up data that challenges the announced policies. Remember I said in the previous tape, the messenger who moves slowly has bad news. The messenger who runs has good news. If everybody knows his boss is committed to a given course of action, that he's overcommitted to it, he never knows what's happening. How do you avoid such results in your organization? By avoiding overcommitment in the first place, if that's possible. But if you've had to put yourself on a limb, know where you are and keep your ear cocked for the sound of the saw. And let your immediate subordinates know that you're interested in every piece of threatening information. Your people must know that you always respect the facts, even if they fly in the face of your theories. Next, remember that there's another thing to understand in the use of power, and that is inertia. Policies often start out right, but a changing environment makes them inappropriate. Yet, as in physics, once you've started in a given direction, the tendency is to continue. There is only one remedy: periodic reviews of your basic premises and a constant check of the data that tell you whether your assumptions prove to be true. Naturally, those who launch projects are bound to be prejudiced in its favor. and will not take pleasure in confronting data that indicate disaster lies ahead. All the more reason, then, for power people to lend an attentive ear to signals from the troops. There is a caveat which I want to add on getting messages from the troops. As a general, you don't want to upset the normal channels of communication, but yet you want to encourage information. Now, suppose somebody tells you that something is rotten in Denmark. Somebody is abusing the expense account. Something is going wrong in the factory, and he comes to you as a manager. Now, how do you protect the information? Because let me tell you, your grapevine will be cut off if you reveal that Ted told you something and confront the other individual with that information. Based upon years of experience, because obviously as a psychologist, I have been involved with organizations where the information comes up, and the president frequently, the way he handles that information will decide whether he gets more. One test of whether you help your people communicate with you is how you treat information they give you in confidence. If you haven't had an occasion to grapple with this problem, that fact itself may be a warning. In any organization, there will be frictions and incidences that people will be reluctant to talk about. Yet the executive must know about them if he's to safeguard all the people involved and the interests of the organization. As an industrial psychologist, by the way, my effectiveness is ruined if I bring information to the president about his organization and he reveals the source. I just do it to help him. What do you do when a subordinate or even a peer lets you in on a situation but asks you to protect your sources? You don't have the shield law like the legislation enacted to protect journalists. On the other hand, rejoice that you're not subject to subpoena. These questions are primarily ethical. Moreover, remember that if you violate the confidence, you will close the door to future communication. In most cases, these guidelines should help you decide an appropriate course of action about privileged information. 1, express your information to your informant for his communication, especially if it required soul-searching on his part, which is, I didn't really want to tell you. You must have been concerned about this situation, and I'm grateful for your thoughtfulness. 2, respect his integrity. Don't press him to identify his source or to tell you more than he feels free to tell you. Part of your reaction must be to protect him from self-reproach. 3, in any action you take, make every effort to safeguard your source. Keep him out of the line of fire. You owe it to him. 4, don't go for your gun. Think it over. The lapse of time will help you to protect your source and give you a chance to plan your response to the problem. 5, concentrate on the situation itself rather than the subsidiary question of why people weren't frank with you in the first place. After your anger has cooled, you'll be in a better position to handle that. 6, seek confirmation from other sources. Judicious questioning may give you additional facts. In any case, you have now been alerted to the problem. Visit the site, kick the tires, so to say, and see where the problem is. 7, once you've disposed of the matter, make an effort to forget it. Don't harbor grudges or plan retaliation. I think that one has to understand that information will flow if you follow these recommendations. And if you don't get information, it means that maybe you're blocking it off. And yet it is a very critical factor in your role as a powerful leader. Now, one might rightfully ask, why do people want power in the first place? It causes problems, causes tensions, causes challenges. I think because every human being needs to live up to the limits, the talents that God gave them. I think that we all have a responsibility not to be a wasteland. I loved the book which I read as adolescence by a writer called Joe Sinclair, in which he pointed out that many people's lives are wastelands, that there is a big gap between what they are and what they might have been. So that I think the need for competence, the need for power, is to live up to your own unique potential. And let me also point out that power people, power men and women, are people who are testing themselves. They are not gamblers. They don't go to Las Vegas, by the way. In fact, very few presidents of companies spend a lot of time on gambling tables. In fact, I once sat next to a president of one of the massive companies in the United States, on a Fortune 500, and we were at a Yale-Harvard football game, and he wouldn't bet. I said, why don't you bet? He says, because I can't control the players out there. He said, and yet, the week before, he had consummated a $5 billion acquisition. I said, you won't bet? Yes. He said, I won't bet a dollar, but I'm willing to bet billions. He said, when I think my input can affect the results. Again, it's power, self-confidence, and need to fulfill oneself, and not, as I pointed out, the trappings of power. Now, there are counterfeit executives, counterfeit power users. They're not the real McCoy. Let me tell you very briefly, because of the problem of time, what their characteristics are. The counterfeit executive might be described in the following way. Egocentric, who advances the expense of others. The efficiency expert is another counterfeit executive who feels that personalities and people can be ignored and systems substituted for the human touch. The yes man, who advances by just being around, by having long and undistinguished service. When I was in the Marine Corps, working as a consultant for the U.S. Marine Corps, I interviewed a man and I said, well, tell me about what you've done. And after I couldn't get anything out of him, he said, just put down, doctor, I've been around. And he got to be a sergeant by being around. The frightened man, who likes individuals but is afraid of groups. The hard man, who acts like a feudal lord. And these, by the way, are often, psychologists have observed, major causes of failure. Because they are like the emperor without clothes. They are what the Irish refer to as an empty suit. They have the suit of power, but not the substance of power. One of the most important challenges in the use of power is the ability of the manager to delegate responsibility without the grave danger of abrogating his own power. I'd like to start with the recognition that delegation is critical, first, because nobody's ever going to learn how to do an effective job without having done it. You cannot learn how to play golf or tennis or make love by reading books. You have to do it and learn to some degree from your errors. Now, I'm not against reading books or listening to tapes. I've been the author of 5 books myself. But I want to point out that the real question addressing ourselves to at this point in the tape is the need to recognize that if you don't delegate, one, you will be you're abrogating your responsibility to the company to train other people. Second, you're going to lose good people. An organization that is characterized by its unwillingness to share power will soon find very few able people around. Beginning with the chief executive and the individual department heads, there is a highly developed sense of territory. Subordinates need to feel that even if they are not in complete control, they can still influence events, at least by persuasion, if not by command. Much more effective, however, is the actual dispersion of power that is achieved by delegation, a grant of authority and responsibility to those at lower rungs who are adjusted to be competent is critical. Another very critical reason for delegation is the ability to relieve you of those daily responsibilities which drain your energy and divert you from your major role the higher up you go in an organization as the major strategist. Kenneth Axelson, who left JCPenney to do work in the New York City government, when he returned from his government service, found that his people were getting along very well without him. And he said that was great because now it liberated him to do those things in the strategic planning area which he should have been doing all along, but which he didn't have the energy to do because he had not delegated sufficiently. So I would say that the key question in any organization that must be asked of its key executives is the following. One, just what should and should not the manager delegate? Two, how the company expects the delegation to be carried out. It may be argued that a good manager should be able to answer these questions for himself. But how many good managers will a company have if it fails to enunciate its policies and train its people to implement them? Let me give you the crucible demonstration of the effective use of power, and that is in delegation. And let me give you some guidelines about how to delegate effectively. I think I have demonstrated to you that it is important, but I've not given you, which I try to do with these tapes, to give you some specific recommendations which you can follow. Now, there is a no simple rule of thumb. I've called it in a very grandiose fashion, a fail-safe method of delegation. I don't believe there's anything that's fail-safe, but it will decrease the opportunity for failure in delegation if you follow these recommendations. One, what is the goal of the delegation? What do you want to accomplish by it? Do you want to remove yourself from daily pressures? Do you want to train the individual? Do you want to spend more time in strategic planning? Do you want to provide for your succession? First, what's the goal? Two, choose your delegatee without letting him at first know that he's been chosen. Observe not only his experience and familiarity with the job, but also his drive, ambition, and ego strength. That last point, ego strength, is very important. A subordinate may have all of the requisite knowledge and tools, but it takes a certain toughness to be able to withstand the frustrations and disappointments that can be involved in handling an important project on your own. If a subordinate has not yet built that kind of inner strength, he may not be ready for the delegation of important tasks. Next, let your managers bite off as much as they can chew. Let them ride with their own decisions as much as possible. Let them learn from their own mistakes. Let them revel in their own successes. By so doing, you not only motivate competent people, you also build people, both men and women, who can be relied upon when the going gets tough. Some management expert once said, give your man a project and the freedom to do with it as he wants. Make sure that he or she can either break it or make it. Meanwhile, protect yourself by making sure that the project is in the area of his interest. Remember, I told you earlier, know him. Chances are that the person will work like a devil to make the project go. There was a great banker in California by the name of Joe Crail, whom I worked with. Over the years, he was president of the Coast Federal Savings and Loan. And he tried to make certain that his subordinates bore the responsibility as well as the risks of decision-making. Crail, for example, had set up a strict policy on when and when not to grant loans to applicants. If one of his staff recommends an exception to the policy, Crail used to say, "Okay, but you will have to share the risks. I don't want you to play games with my marbles alone. If a loan is forfeited, you'll pay half and I'll pay half. If the loan is repaid, I'll give you all of the interest." Crail reported to me that only two men have took him up on this proposition. One man is now the president of the bank, and the other is the president of a rival bank. So that it is important to know what you're dealing with and to give them some rewards as well as punishments with the delegation. Next, I think it is important that you discuss the delegation with the person without making a specific assignment necessarily at that time. Talk to your chosen delegatee. Make it clear that you don't necessarily have a specific task to delegate at that moment. Rather, you're looking towards a method of operation in the future. Under these circumstances, he can and will reveal to you a great many things concerning his state of mind about delegation without feeling that he has to say yes or no at that moment. Next, previous considerations and conversations satisfy you. Make a provisional delegation. Provisional delegations work this way. You lay out for the subordinate everything he needs to know and give him all the tools and authority necessary. But you say, "I'll be working with you for the first stage of this project." And you do work with him. You do not send him right off on his own. At the same time, he understands that you're going to phase yourself out of the operation. He has you around so that he can ask questions without feeling that he's not handling his responsibilities. And you can observe closely the speed and facility with which he moves into the assignment. Phase yourself out with built-in checkpoints. Pull out of the operation and let him handle it. However, before you do it, set up specific and formal points at which the operation will be reviewed. Talk about this as a normal part of the delegation procedure. Now the subordinate is operating on his own, but he knows that you'll have an opportunity to discuss it with you. By setting up guidelines like these, by these rules, especially, you will be getting ready for the case of permanent delegation. Contact should be maintained for the purpose not only of control, but to give assistance, recognition, and encouragement as necessary or desirable. Most important thing is to remember that you will serve as the lighthouse for all your ships at sea. Maybe as things go on, you can space out all your checkpoints to a greater or lesser degree. Maybe you can substitute a more informal, occasional drop-in chat to make certain that the delegation has gone well. And I guess most important, remember to praise when the delegation is going well. Give the person a booster shot, a psychological push. Remember I told you in a previous tape about the pat on the fanny. Here are some boosters when the delegation has gone well that I would remind you to use. Unexpected praise. commend the worker for unusual performance in an area where he may not even know you've been watching. Take additional incentives, often a short-term reward, even a modest one, such as a free lunch or a day off, pays rich dividends. Evidence of company recognition. Let the person know that others outside the company are watching and approving. You might say you met with a board member and he thought that Tom did a fantastic job on the recent review of one of his books. You can circulate and post a commendatory letter from the president, maybe post it on the bulletin board of the organization. I think it's critical that delegation be done effectively, and when so, don't be stinting in your praise of that performance, which is a real test of your leadership and your power.